Well, thank you so much. That was wonderful. Thanks so much. The words in the prologue were enough to let me know I'd be hooked on the book. They read in part, "Digging through my immediate mind, which distracts itself with pizza, paper clips, and the rising and falling of the Dow, I uncover old dwellings, a house, a temple, a town square once occupied, believed in, faithfully tended. I stumble. My mind wanders through layers of rubble, discarded beliefs, outworn creeds, broken hopes, and false saviors. I never arrived at the promised vision. I believed in the Lord Jesus Christ with as much heart, mind, and soul as I could manage. But he failed to save me from death's dominion and the fear of nothingness. I trusted Freud to lead me down to an underworld from which I returned wounded, with little redemptive wisdom other than a sermon on coping. Marx, in whom I never believed, taught me better than he knew the dangers of all utopias. Tired of pure reason, I dreamed the dark kingdom of Dionysius in an orgy of the senses until I learned what Apollo knew: order may be sweet. A skilled archaeologist might map more layers, passions, purses, and places I thought might save me from what I'm not certain and give me peace at last. Should I mourn and build again? Clear away the debris, prepare a new edifice to house my spirit. Wherever I stand, tectonic plates tumble. I am earthquake prone, not a good insurance risk." Okay, truth time. I knew I was going to buy and read this book even before I read its opening words. They're by one of my theological mentors, Dr. Sam Keen, whose stuff I've been reading probably for the past 40 years or so, beginning with his very early work in the late 1960s called To a Dancing God. Took a 5-week summer series course from Dr. Keen a couple summers ago, and it was really a joy to meet and converse with someone that I had known all that time through his work, but had never had any kind of a face-to-face encounter with. And at the time that I was spending that week with him, he was putting the finishing touches on this latest book of his, so I knew it was going to be near the top of my reading list when it came out sometime later, and I got around to it this past summer. The full title is In the Absence of God, Dwelling in the Presence of the Sacred. Note those two words, because they're the recurring themes throughout the book: absence and presence. Without, I hope, insulting Mr. Keen by boiling his fine book down to a single sentence, I'll say it's about, as his prologue suggests, where one goes when the gods of both the religious and the secular realms come up short and fail the seeker. And my journey hasn't exactly paralleled the one that Dr. Keen writes about. But as I read it through, I realized that with some adjustments here and there, I could have written a personal odyssey very similar to the prologue that he offers in his book. That was probably why I got so hooked on it. Sam Keen, as noted, is a philosopher and a theologian, a writer, an educator, various other kinds of things like that. But it was a novelist, the late John Updike, who also captured the dilemma that Keen faces in the character, in Updike's character of Harry Rabbit Angstrom. In Updike's early novel, Rabbit Run, Harry owns and operates an automobile dealership in the fictitious town of Brewer, Pennsylvania. Rabbit Run was the first of 4 rabbit novels Updike would write. Term rabbit is a nickname from Harry's earlier days of glory on the Brewer High School basketball team, where he was known for darting all around the court like a rabbit. And now he's just a guy, trying to make a living and raise a family, deal with just the day-to-day stuff of middle-class American life. Now, Updike's rabbit doesn't have the same kind of language or the same kind of knowledge base or the same kind of life experience as does the real-life Dr. Keene, but he's having a similar kind of a struggle of the spirit or a crisis of meaning. And Harry's not a regular churchgoer, but he befriends the local Episcopal minister, Reverend Eccles, and the two of them become golfing buddies. And in their trips to the golf course, it's those trips to the golf course that give Harry and Reverend Eccles a chance to talk about Harry's vague and largely undefined spiritual yearnings, yearnings he barely even knows he has. And that brings to one of my favorite passages in the annals of American literature, which is a conversation between Rabbit Angstrom and Reverend Eccles as they're driving off for a round of golf. And after the two of them have a brief exchange about religion, we get this passage with Harry speaking. "Well, I don't know about all this theology, but I'll tell you, I do feel, I guess, that somewhere behind all this," Harry gestures outward at the scenery. They're passing the housing development on this side of the golf course, half wood, half brick, 1.5 stories in little flat bulldozed yards, holding tricycles and spindly 3-year-old trees. The ungrandest landscape in the world. "Somewhere behind all this, there's something that wants me to find it." Well, be it a fictitious car dealer or a real-life philosopher, theologian, and writer, Rabbit Angstrom and Sam Keene are dealing with the same thing, which is to say, a reaching beyond themselves for something that will give their lives some greater depth and meaning, not quite knowing what this it is that they seek, but knowing everything they've tried keeps coming up short. "Wherever I stand, tectonic plates tumble. I am earthquake prone. Somewhere behind all this, there's something that wants me to find it." Updike purposefully gives his character the last name of Angstrom. It's a play on the German-derived word angst, meaning a kind of nameless and largely unfocused anxiety or sadness that one can live with well enough, but it keeps hanging around. And throughout the four rabbit novels that Updike writes, Harry never quite finds God or a God equivalent. Updike takes his readers through this ordinary guy's life with its ups and downs in the latter half of 20th century middle-class America as he tries to make some sense of his life. And in the fourth and final rabbit novel called Rabbit at Rest, an aging Harry Angstrom, now a grandfather, dies of a heart attack in a one-on-one game of basketball with a young African-American fellow some 40 years his junior. In other words, he goes back to the activity that gave him the highest point in his life, the closest he ever got to God, one might say, when he was in high school. Well, what Updike's characters get then in the character of Rabbit Angstrom is a life lived in the absence of God, or if you prefer some other term, lived in the absence of some higher or unifying purpose to his life. And for Harry, it's not a completely barren life. It's not one that is completely devoid of any kind of meaning or purpose. Harry does well enough for himself throughout his life, even with his occasional infidelities. If you've read Updike, you know Updike couldn't have written all he wrote if he couldn't write about marital infidelity, one of those ongoing themes in his work. It's just that Harry's life never quite reaches the level of fulfillment to which he aspired or the glory that he had known back there on his high school basketball court. Well, okay, let's leave Rabbit to his rest. We'll go back to Dr. Keene. For his book, as the title suggests, is about where one goes after the encounter of the absence of God, the absence of a supreme being, that is to say, or the absence of any of the number of the secular or religious gods one can turn to. And Keene happens to regard such an encounter with absence as a promising beginning point rather than an end. He's writing about where one goes after you clear the forest. Some of our new wave of atheists, as I call them, people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, they do a pretty good job of clearing the forest about warm beliefs and superstitions. But that's really about as far as they go. And while he doesn't mention them by name, it was probably these folks that Keene had in mind when he writes in here about, quoting him, "the voices of the new atheologians who condemn the violence of religious fundamentalism, but who are angry at a God in whom they do not believe." Kind of like that line. For Sam's observation does raise an interesting question. How much energy does one really need to spend debunking the existence of a God you don't believe in to begin with? My answer is not too much. That's speaking for myself. The next step, as I've come to see it and which is echoed in this text, as to where one goes in the absence of the God of supernatural theism, is not to come up necessarily with another God, but it is to cultivate a particular way of looking at and being in the world. And that gets us to the second part of the subtitle of the book, Dwelling in the Presence of the Sacred. For Dr. Keene is not just writing about absence, he's also writing about how and where we dwell, how we go about being really and truly dwellers in the world and universe in which we inhabit for however much time we're given to be in it. So after he writes about the failed gods of both religion and secularism and on how his personal tectonic plates keep shifting around on him, Keene goes to this. "I think it is better to dwell in the desert under open spaces, looking for hidden oases. Make a hearth, light a fire, cherish sunrise, noonday, moonset, a flight of Canada geese, an ant empire being built an arm's length away, the comfort of touch, the language of glances, smiles, laughter, tears, sacred moments. Be thankful for the myriad hints of a G-D present in absence, in the longing without end." Well, I'm going to ask you to indulge me for a few minutes now, if you will, so I can bring some of my personal journey into these thoughts. I said earlier, I could have written a similar prologue about my life as Sam Keene does with his, even though I would frame mine a little bit differently. For I think of my own journey, which I know I've shared bits and pieces of it here from this pulpit, I think of my own journey, though, as moving through four lands, with each land containing similar components of those of Sam Keene's. I'm in kind of a reflective mood this year, so today I'll take you across my landscapes of the spirit. My first land, southern West Virginia, and Sam Keene's, it was in rural Tennessee, very similar. My first land was characterized by the sin and salvation styles of worship services in the Evangelical Baptist Church in which I was raised and where my father was a deacon. It actually was a very safe and a very loving place. A safe and loving place, that is, for those who were on the inside, for those who were saved. The kindly minister who spent his whole parish ministry career with that one church was the first person I wanted to be like when I grew up. And I was honored when a man that I could see being as highly regarded as him, I was very honored when he took a personal interest in a nerdy, bookish, nowhere junior high school kid like me. That was the setting in which I preached my first sermons. I found I kind of liked it, so I just kept doing it. I wasn't too long for this land, however, due in large part to my college experience. I managed to find my way to a second land called the land of liberal mainline social activist American Protestantism. This was the land that was characterized by my seminary days and my early years in the ministry as a university chaplain a la Gary Trudeau's Reverend Scott Sloan of the Doonesbury comics. If you know who Scott Sloan is, that was part of my land for a time. And while I never lost my affection for my hometown minister, my minister mentors in those days were people like Martin Luther King and William Sloan Coffin and the Berrigan brothers. These were folks I only met very briefly in passing, had no relationship with them like my hometown minister. But they epitomized for me what it meant to live an authentic religious and spiritual life. I still admire them greatly. Dan Berrigan is the only one of those who is still alive. Well then, next land comes about the mid-70s or thereabouts, and that was when the tectonic plates really began to move as I took this little excursion into the humanistic psychology movement. Part of that consisted with hanging out for two or three summers with some very bright and rather crazy people in the Bay Area there. Probably better save those stories for some other time, if I ever decide to tell them at all. But craziness aside, this era and landscape did prove to be a time of some real soul searching, which led me to leave the land of even the liberal Christian ministry, bidding farewell to Scott Sloan, and declare myself a humanist and an agnostic, if not an atheist, when it came to the rejection of the idea of a supernatural God. And I was hanging pretty loose in those times. Was not married, no family responsibilities. Didn't really have a permanent home, you know, living in an apartment here for a few years, doing something, an apartment there for a few years. You know, kind of my on-the-road stage of my life. And I figured I would just see where things in this third land might take me. And after a few fits and starts, it was while moving across this landscape that I did find my way to the Unitarian Universalist ministry. I said there were four lands, though. It means there's still one to go. My travels through this fourth land of the UU ministry that I moved into has not exactly been like the one Dr. King describes, in the sense that I never really felt betrayed so much by a religious and secular God as I just felt I had gone about as far as I could go in one particular piece of territory, and it was time to move on. But I still kind of come out in the same place. This is where Dr. King here does. I've been in this land of the UU ministry now, longer than any of the others I've cited, some 33 years in all, 23 and counting right here. And I must thank you for giving me a land in which to wander. For it's been a land where I can search for the sacred, whether it involves any kind of a God or not. I kind of like Keene's shorthanded way of saying God. Well, throughout this book, he has a G and then a hyphen and then a D. What he's trying to do, he's trying to indicate that he's searching for something which cannot be fully named or fully known, but he still believes the search is worth the journey. And so the land I move through now is the one that comes after the absence of a traditional God, to a land in which one can dwell in the presence of the sacred. There's a $10 highfalutin theological term for this land, which I know I've invoked before you as I've tracked my journey. It's called panentheism. It's not meant to be one more stab at a definition of God so much as it is a life stance, as I've already indicated. It's a life stance. It's a way of looking at life. It's a particular way of encountering the world we live in. It's a mindset that allows us to see life in a certain way. And as I've found, it's not a stance one can continually maintain. You come into it and out of it now and then. To use one of Sam's metaphors, it's the occasional discovery of a hidden oasis in a desert. For panentheism holds that there is something of the sacred, something of the holy, contained within the ordinary or the everyday, or even in the fallen and the broken places of life. And if we can just stay open to that possibility, the sacred, the holy will on occasion break through. There's a passage in the writing of the Hindu poet and philosopher Rabindranath Tagore that describes what I would call a panentheistic moment. I don't know the particular experience which he's referring to in this passage, but these are his words. I suddenly felt as if some ancient mist had been lifted from my sight, and the ultimate significance of all things laid bare. And no person or thing in the world seemed trivial to me or unpleasing. That, I feel, is what it means to really and truly realize life. To see no person or thing in the world as trivial. As I said, it's a moment you come in and out of. From the standpoint of panentheism, Tagore is describing a God moment. You may call it what you will, because the experience is far, far more important than the name that's attached to it. And this is not a standpoint that will protect one from life's tragedies and pains and sometimes terrible absurdities. There is no God in this kind of theology for one to get angry with or enraged at. Rather, what's being offered is a perspective for keeping faith with life in the midst of both its blessings as well as its curses. To pick up on an earlier thread, as I say, I consider it one of my life's blessings to have a place where I can pursue some of these questions of meaning and share my wanderings through the lands of the Spirit with others. I've also learned on this journey that one can live a perfectly good, full, meaningful life without giving much concern to who or what God may be, absent or present. And some of these folk find their way into this and other UU congregations I've served. I've been and continue to be delighted to know them and to interact with them. But I guess I've got still just enough of the Harry Angstrom in me to at least get a sense, as he did, that somewhere behind all this, there's something that wants me to find it. And there's still enough of the agnostic in me to admit that, like Harry, I'm never going to fully know what that something is. But even so, there remains enough of the religious and spiritual journey maker in me to keep me on the voyage. A couple more quick points before closing here. I've used terms like sacred and holy to identify a presence or a force or a power, which I believe, as I've been saying, is contained within the world of people and events in nature that surrounds us and not somewhere beyond it. If pressed to give a precise definition of such terms as sacred or holy, I know I can't really do it. But then I can't give a precise definition of things like beauty or love or peace or joy either. But I still believe in them, and I believe in them deeply. I would offer as well that to cultivate an awareness of the sacredness and the holiness of life is to be sensitized to when that sacredness is violated. For I am not, in the end, speaking of or advocating for a kind of feel-good spirituality here that is purely inner-directed. For to truly dwell in the presence of the sacred is to be called to justice-making. It is to be called to stand on the side of love. To truly dwell in the presence of the sacred is to be sensitized to and angered when the sacred is violated. When human lives are willfully abused, mistreated, or denied certain necessities of life, like, say, food and shelter and safety, then the sacred is violated. When the natural world is unduly despoiled or desecrated purely for the sake of human greed, then the sacred is violated. When lives are diminished or trivialized or destroyed due to hatred, bigotry, prejudice, or just plain indifference, the sacred is violated. And when innocent lives fall prey to the drums of war, the sacred is violated, however sound or not the rationale for the use of force may be. All of this to say that a true engagement with the sacred then leads one not only inward, but outward as well, to a fuller and deeper engagement with his or her world. One of my continuing goals in the ministry I am privileged to share with you is to offer here, with your help, a safe and accepting land, or a series of lands, for each one of us to make our journeys of the spirit, journeys of the mind, journeys of exploration, just as I have been able to make mine. So I'll finish by saying, may we continue to learn from one another. May we all be blessed by the spirit of life that enfolds and holds all of us together. On that note, let's sing our closing hymn, Blessed Spirit of My Life. It's number 86.